very fragile.
Wow, that was a lot of horn going on there. Welcome to the Interracial Dawn Podcast. I'm your host, Leslie Mack, and I'm joined as always
by every white guy.
And you are very white indeed. And if this is your first time joining us, welcome. You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Interracial Dawn. That's J-A-W-N. Or go to our website, interracialdawn.com. Please do subscribe on any of those two platforms. We'd love to get subscribers. You can also find us on all of your social media outlets at Interracial Dawn. Again, J-A-W-N. And you can leave us feedback on iTunes or Stitcher. You can also email us. interracialjohn@gmail.com, or you can pick up your phone, dial 657-JAWNERS, 657-JAWNERS, and leave us a voicemail.
Feedback's free. Sorry.
All right, come on, guys.
Clear my throat.
We've been out here trying to grind, so get us some feedback or something. Drop us a line.
We're like back to weekly.
Come on, y'all.
Maybe the average of the last couple months has been like every 8 days. We're pretty good.
Something like that. Uh-huh. Yeah.
No voicemails, nothing?
No, we didn't have any voicemails or any of the things. So, yeah.
Notice me, senpai. Notice me.
So, what's going on with you? What's the haps?
We'll start with it's all kind of like bad, I guess, the three things we're going to talk about. Levine's Museum of the New South.
Okay, y'all. So, as y'all know, we moved to Charlotte recently. Well, it's been, 7 months now, 6 months now, something like that?
Yeah, whatever. October-ish.
And, we have been, on the road. I've been on the road a significant amount of time since we moved. We also took a vacation ourselves. I went on a trip as well since we moved here. So we haven't spent a lot of time in Charlotte. And so we...
Much less exploring.
Right. So we're just starting now, finally, to be like, okay, you know, the weather's getting nicer here. Let's try and venture out a little bit. I had heard about this public market, which was kind of like a food market.
An open-air market.
The open-air market type of thing.
So what I was like, called? The free market?
The public, 7th Street public market.
7th Street public market.
And so I was like,
"Lots of good food, to be honest."
Yeah, I was like, "Cool, I heard about this. It's nice. We have a morning off yesterday. Let's drive downtown and let's check it out." So we go check it out. We ate. Food was fine. Everything was great. Actually, it was full of like white people hiding their March for Our Lives signs.
Tangent. Like that was literally. I said that to Leslie. There was chock full of kids, young students that were doing the March for Their Lives, and they're obviously participating in the march. But there was this weird, like, odd behavior of hiding their posters.
Like I saw. One of them was in front of me and they were like stuffing it in their bag.
Like rolled it up like, oh my God, I don't want to be seen with this. And like, I've been in like straight up Walmarts with like Raise Better White People and someone's like, what's that mean? Like, oh shit, I forgot I was wearing that.
But
that was weird.
Anyway. Yeah. So that was,
lunch. We had a good
lunch. And so we had some more, we had time. We were not in a rush.
You loved your grilled cheese sandwich.
I did.
The like savory crepe thing I had was phenomenal.
Yeah, my grilled cheese sandwich was great. So anyway, so we had good food and we were like, oh, let's go walk around, whatever. So we dropped our little bags off at the car and then we went to go just take a walk anywhere. I looked up like a bakery to walk to, but we really were just trying to check out the downtown. So right across the street from the market is the Levine Museum of the New South. And so we had passed and I was like, oh, well, we can check it out on the way back, see if it's something we want to see or whatever.
We're into museums.
We love museums. Like, really, we love museums. So we're like, cool. So on our way back, we decided to pop into the Levine Museum of the New South. I'll let you take it from here because I really, like, didn't even absorb all of it because I was like, my, like, hackles were already up, like, from the first room we walked into and they made us watch this little intro video that completely, like... I don't know, like sad songed, like all of the horrible shit that happened to black people down here, but whatever, go ahead.
It didn't go past me.
Not even exaggerating. They literally just had all of these horrible images, like Ku Klux Klan, all this stuff, but it was just like music.
No, I'll go through a whole bunch of it. But so black folk at the ticket counter, and like you said, the first part of the exhibit is to go watch this video. And it's like straight up like revisionist / like propaganda, like horse shit. It, like Leslie said, it like, what was that from Seinfeld? You know, the yada yada, I mentioned the bisque. Like they basically yada yada like chattel slavery and kind of like, and when I say yada yada, they literally were like, at the end of the Civil War, a new way of farming had to be invented.
A new way of farming.
You're like, they had to find a new way.
You mean the one that doesn't treat people as cattle? Oh.
So the movie was like kind of fucked up and weird. And it really was like, it talked about cotton and cotton mills as this like great saving thing. Like, you know, like the Industrial Revolution was wonderful, but like, you know, fuck around black people, whatever. Mm-hmm. But so, and like you said, they had all sorts of pieces that like throughout it gave this like so forced attempt at showing two sides of everything. When I say forced attempt, at one point they literally like, I have to go to where the first fucking, okay, there's a bunch of things. One, they're talking about the Klan, the KKK, and they reference specifically that they were also used to intimidate poor white voters. Mm. And the picture they have of the KKK is them with a noose around a fucking like white kid. When I say white kid, I'm talking like straight, like parted hair, like clearly a white kid. No one's like, oh, that could be a passing. Like, nope, that is a white kid. That's the KKK photo they decided to show.
Mm-hmm.
Noose around a white kid? Come the fuck on.
Yeah.
You know? And like, it didn't even end there. There was like a bajillion things like that. And I don't know if I threaded it properly, but like, let me get my phone because I have to now. It was so fucking bad. It really was like, I didn't even ask people on Twitter. I'm like, okay, is it me or is this like as bad as I fucking think it is? And I was like, it's that bad.
It was bad in there. Like, it was just really weird to basically see, and this is how I positioned it when I was talking somebody yesterday about it, was basically it was like very light touches mentioning slavery in the portions that slavery was happening. Then they had like one little like panel and like a wall devoted to Reconstruction, which as y'all know is just a 10-year period. Then it went to Ku Klux Klan, like scaring everybody. As you mentioned, they highlight them scaring white people. Then it literally, that's it. You don't even, there's no mention of black people at all in the South from 1880 all the way to 1960.
Yeah, it's really bad.
In the whole museum, y'all, there's literally no black people. Oh, I'm sorry. They have one black singing quartet. That's it.
I'll go through that's the Golden Gate Quartet, which is fantastic.
It's not even about that. Yeah. I'm just saying.
It's a sidebar. I just really like them. Anyway, mm-hmm. Here's a bunch of the really problematic shit. First exhibit, like you said, is this video that's like revisionist and like almost like inaccurate. Very first placard, they have like posters and shit. And this is supposed to represent 1860 to 1920. In the old South, the Piedmont Rocky Rivers and poor roads made it hard to get crops to market. Most white people lived on isolated small farms, growing just what they needed to eat. Only a few whites owned plantations worked by African American slaves. That's in the Old South. That's literally the fucking paragraph one of the Old South. Railroads and war transformed the Piedmont. Starting in 1850s, 1860s, railroads made it easy to get cash crops to market. The Civil War ended slavery. Just one little sentence there. In the New South, farmers could now raise cotton and sell it to mills up north. Would this bring risk or reward? African Americans were now free citizens. How would they live and work? In the years after the Civil War, Southerners struggled to reinvent their rural world. The deliberate positioning of whiteness against blackness in every fucking stage was so, so fucking gross. I gotta find some other ones. Let's see here. Okay. They're literally talking about tenant farming, right? Like after chattel slavery ends, there's slavery of a different name. And they're talking about sharecropping and people that are on tenant farms. They don't own the land, but they're working it. And they said by 1890, three of every four black farmers in North Carolina were tenants on someone else's land. So three out of four black farmers are tenants. Right fucking next door to it. One out of three white farmers in North Carolina were a tenant on someone else's land. But they don't give you the percentage and the number of farmers where like in 1890, I think every black person was farming. I don't think that was true of every white person. You know what I mean? Like the whole juxtaposition shit was grotesque. At one point they had responses to the civil rights movement and it included like some kind of like respectability shit on the black side.
Yep.
And then side by fucking side, panel by panel, was like armed black resistance, like just call it like black separatist, black liberation movement that was, you know, happened to be armed, whether they called the Panthers ever an armed black resistance. Right fucking next to it, the KKK. Like a grand fucking wizard in green and fucking pointy hat next to like fucking like Huey Newton. I swear to God, it was like, are you fucking kidding me? And then the responses to the civil rights movement, half of them were white. And like they were like all problematic as fuck.
Oh.
Like one dude that was a columnist that wrote shit and like profited off of like making fun of racism. A white woman that had dinners I'm dead ass serious. That was what she did.
Yep.
Had dinners at her house.
Dinners at her house, yeah.
I was like, and the Klansmen, oh my God. It just was so bad. Mm-hmm. And again, just they struggled at every fucking instance to have some sort of commentary about white people. They only grew what they needed to eat, and very, very few of them owned plantations with slaves. They had a goddamn like working fucking ass like cotton mill where you could like touch and feel cotton and shit. Like, that's not fucking traumatic in any way for some people. It was the most revisionist, like, I swear, propagandist. I couldn't believe it was a museum. And then I was like, oh yeah, Blackout, right? They did Museum Blackout because museums are completely fuck ass and horrible when it comes to all kinds of shit. Like the dictionary, who writes it, who decides what
who
gets
does
done.
Indeed.
I want to know who sponsored this museum. Who
I need more information about it. If anybody knows, let us know.
Oh, I honestly, like,
it was really disturbing.
And I'm not even like, I'm not saying like, ooh, like I'm this or that, like the wokest, whatever, whatever. But like, there's definitely
definitely not the wokest.
Thank you. But there's a level of like where you just like, you just see through the obvious bullshit with a pretty easy lens. When like the white supremacy is just like not even like barely covered. It's just like, you know, like you didn't even try to dog whistle it. And this is one of those things where it's like, how can you not see the horribly obvious juxtaposition? Like, you were meant to come out of there with like, blacks didn't have it that hard and whites had it hard too. Like, literally,
we're all literally in the gift shop. The t-shirt told you everybody's history matters, y'all. That's what their t-shirts say.
Yours, theirs, others, everyone's history matters. And I said, like, this is some all matters. Lives bullshit. And like, it's not all lives. Like, are you kidding me?
Anytime you use something, stop using blah, 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 blah matters.
Yours, mine,
just
ours.
Stop. Everyone's stop using it. Because when you say that shit, we know what you mean.
Yeah. And the person, someone from the museum, like, responded on Twitter, like, oh,
dumbasses.
You take an objection to the content, the display, or the history there? I'm like, well, I'm taking objection to the display, like how you're like presenting it, right? And I'd be all happy if you had a museum of like whiteness that was like actual and factual. You know what I mean? Like, they did have one picture of an actual lynching of two black people being lynched, and they had a little flap over it. But the people lynching the white kid was there for everyone to see. The like part about the civil rights movement had like some things you could listen to, and it was all like trauma porn stuff.
Mm.
Like the hoses, the bridge on Birmingham, MLK's assassination. I was like, what the fuck? Like, the whole thing was really bad. And I, like I said, would love to know who did it. And it was so thinly veiled. It was like exhibit after exhibit. I was just like, are you kidding me? This is getting worse and worse and worse and worse.
Just terrible. It was terrible.
Yep.
We won't be going back.
No, please short. Don't. Please
what
don't.
Else did you have to share with the people?
It's just taxes. And just, you know, like one of my friends from Argentina, because they have their payment in Argentina when you get like salary, you have a debit card and you can only have one or two banks, and they issue a debit card and we pay the bank, and then the bank takes the money and gives it to the government, and the bank gives you what's left. So there's no taxes in Argentina. It's just like, this is my net pay. The government took theirs before I even like had to see it. Right, like it just got handled by somebody else. So they always get like they would ask me like, "What is this taxes? Like, when you got to do your taxes?" And oh man, have our shit gotten complicated. It's just a hassle, and even like getting it ready for somebody else to do is a friggin' hassle. Like the number of like pieces of paper we have and scan and W-1090 blah blah skibbity boo boo. And I understand that's a big privilege. I'm not. I just shouldn't sit here like doing our taxes. Like, woe is me. Like, we have reason and income and things to do the taxes for, but it's just overly complicated. And then I was thinking, like, the new Toupe fiasco rules are gonna, you know, I would say not only benefit us, but I think it'll make it easier. The married standard deduction is gonna like double to $20,000+, and it'll eliminate a lot of people's itemization purpose. And if you're no longer itemizing, you're like, okay, I'm doing basically an easy version, because the individual and the marriage deduction is so massive. It's like doubling. And then some sad news, which I gotta be honest, I'm still kind of processing. Our my BFF, we sometimes jokingly call him your second husband, but his father passed yesterday, rather suddenly, down in Florida, just sort of collapsed. And he's an octogenarian and had a really, really dangerous health scare a couple of years ago. So I think we've all been kind of like, I don't know, assuming Bob was on borrowed time, so to speak. But he was like a father. In fact, he was more of a father to me than my actual father. He was present at a lot of major life events, and he's gonna be missed. And he had a, you know, like, 80-year-olds aren't exactly like, you know, he skirted the line of inappropriate when it came yep. to his humor and stuff.
He did.
And, you know, you give a 80-something-year-old, I guess, a pass, maybe having a little bit of senility as well. But he had a joie de vie that was just kind of beautiful and hilarious, you know, for some. And he was like that his entire life. And it was kind of, he was kind of fun to be around. He had a, especially when he was younger, he had a cutting wit that was just, and he wouldn't say much. He'd be like really quiet and he'd just have a zinger.
Yeah. The zingers would just be like, wa-bam. Yeah. Oh, he definitely would like drop them on you. Yeah. So that's it.
Mm-hmm. Bob, you'll be missed.
Anyway. You will be missed.
Yeah. Do you have anything else that you want to talk about?
Nope.
The news is kind of on.
So actually, I asked Twitter. I was like, hey, you know, there's got to be a list, you know, of people that have come and gone in the 45's administration.
Mm-hmm.
We don't say he should be named on this
Tupac
podcast.
Tupac fiasco.
So simplyfiredlist.com is a list of all the firings and resignations.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got all of them and the number of days. And some of them are literally like, you forgot, like Scaramucci. Yeah. Anthony Scaramucci was the beginning of this. He lasted 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
He's there for just a scooch. Scaramucci. Mm-hmm. Rince Priebus. And he was like, wasn't he like the GOP like chair? Wasn't he like the chairman?
Some shit like that.
He was really big.
Yeah, he was.
He was big. Derek Harvey, don't know who that is. Michael Short, Sean Spicer. Mm. When are you going to see Melissa McCarthy's imitation? It's 180 days. None of these people lasted more than 6 months. 187, 187. Walter Schaub. Elon Musk. I forgot that he was part of the advisory council. Robert Iger, same thing. They resigned from that shit. I mean, the list goes on. I'm trying to think of anybody's. Katie Walsh, Mike Flynn, Sally Yates, 11 days. Craig Deere. Not a one of them has lasted more than 185 days, 187 days. And that's, and this is how you consolate, concentrate power.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the thing you said to me that how many positions are unfilled in the State
because,
Department?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like of the 12 top positions in the State Department, like 7 of them are vacant currently. So we have no State Department. There's nobody actually doing the job the State Department is there to function as, which is obviously pretty critical in today's, you know,
heated environment. And I think that, but the leaving things like that empty allow him to have.
Oh yeah, it's definitely like you. It's a consolidation of power.
Consolidation of power.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's not good.
And you know what, though, this notion does backfire. I saw an article, it said something like, you know, the more cornered Trump is, the more scared I get. And it was almost this like, well, don't push him too far, which I think is so interesting. One, I mean, look, there is a part of that that's true. Like, look, no dog is more dangerous until they're backed into a corner, right? So that's true. And that's not a reason to not like continue pushing. The idea is that you bring enough armor, artillery, and, you know, padding with you to actually confront the dog, right? Not to just be like, well, we don't want it to attack us, so we'll just let it keep ripping up the whole house whenever it wants to, and we won't corner it in case it starts to bark. Like, it's just a terrible, like, supposition.
It sounds a lot like the pre-World War II appeasement strategy.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
That didn't work for shit.
No, it didn't. And it won't work here either.
And it won't work here either.
Plus, he's an idiot, so anyway.
Even the appeasement's like, from every indication I've read, he literally just wants to be approved by the person in front of him. So, like, we'll have like bipartisan meetings and contradict himself because he wants to agree. He wants to have everyone in front of him agree with what he's like, okay, I'll do what you say. Oh, I'll do what he says. Well, I'll do what they say. You know, not exactly a person to be afraid of.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Anywho. Absolutely. Is this next one you're going to talk about Uber killing
somebody? Yeah, so Uber killed somebody this past week, and not in the like, oh, an Uber driver or whatever. Their actual self-driving car hit a bicyclist and killed her. A 49-year-old woman was hit by a car and killed as she crossed the street in Tempe, Arizona.
Sidebar, they did have a live human behind the wheel. They were testing stuff, and they had an actual live person behind the wheel.
Yes, but the car was driving itself.
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. But I'm just saying, like, you know, like when you learn how to, well, you didn't learn how to drive, but when most people, even I don't know if it was an RT, but when most.
Yeah, they have like a separate brake and all of that on their side of the car.
So they had a human able to jump on the brake and, you know, take over and do all kinds of things. But I don't know what the car did or how it, obviously there'll be an investigation, but.
Yeah, definitely. But anyways, they've halted all of their all of their self-driving car testing in the wake of this tragedy. And obviously we feel really sorry for the young woman and her family that lost, not young, but the woman that lost her life and her family who's grieving her. The death comes a year after Uber took its self-driving cars off the road following an accident that left a Volvo SUV on its side in Arizona, and then it was later reinstated. So they had been testing in San Francisco, the Phoenix area, which includes Tempe, Pittsburgh, and Toronto. And so all of those have been halted for the time being. Yeah.
You know, and I'm not saying that, like, they're not at fault, this, that, the other thing, or, you know, but anytime there's new technology, there's often a period where people are kind of afraid of it, and rightfully so, because somebody gets killed. And, like, going all the way back to, like, when you were when people were installing electric trolley cars, like, having electric wires above you was sort of like not a simple prospect, and wires would fall and somebody would get electrocuted and die, and they're like, okay, we told you. Same thing going into tunnels, right? Like, oh, they built this tunnel that goes to this thing. Like, that was really sort of like literally dangerous. Like, toxins would build up, you didn't have fans to kind of exhaust stuff, and like, you didn't really know what was going to happen, and people were dying. And this kind of like feels a bit the same,
it's true.
You know, it's not quite like the Hyperloop thing that Elon wants to make, that's like frightening when it comes to transport. But I always assume there's going to be self-driving, like FedEx, something or other, you know. And I also assume, maybe I'm wrong, but there will be, you know, there's like HOV lanes on the highway. They're going to have lanes that require to have sensing technology front and back. And then they'll be able to, not want to say take over, but you'll get into a lane where they'll allow cars to travel at higher speeds by having some sort of braking and gas technology that senses the car in front of you.
Gotcha.
But you can only get in that if you have a car that's got this equipment and it's giving some signal, and there's literally a gate. And once you get in, the system takes over and literally like shuttles cars in lanes to get you out where you need to go. It'll it'll automate the driving of some sort of experience. It's faster and more.
Oh, so logistic. it's like a hybrid.
Yeah, that'll be where it goes. Like, a new car comes out with the X lane. It's got the X lane technology. Then you can get into an X lane, and all these cars can do this thing where you drive faster.
Gotcha.
But there'll still be people behind the wheel and shit.
Right, it'll be a person back there, but they'll be able to be doing other things. But who knows?
Yeah, I like the sound of a Hyperloop, but it sounds kind of dangerous.
This is an ad for a project.
God damn it! I said we're gonna have an ad. No, okay.
Parking lot, 11:09 p.m. There's a gentleman who's got himself a mop handle, and he is pointing it towards the window of a pickup truck. He's got a stance about shoulder width apart, and he bangs the mop at the top of the window and then hits and resets.
I'll just give you a little, sorry, playing. This is a vandal that was trying to break into a truck, and WKIRO play-by-play announcer took the tape and gave his audio commentary.
He's got his feet now moving apart, looking just to the right to check, make sure no one's around.
Dude's drunk.
And he's now positioning them up again. White backs dude. It up, slams it back into the window. Slams it a second time. That's three. That's four. Las Vegas odds say he won't hit one more time, and he doesn't. Taking a breather, he looks like he's winded. Now he's starting to stumble just a little bit.
And how hard it is to break a window with a wooden mop handle?
He needs a bit more of a running start.
You're like a rock.
And yes, he positions the mop, runs towards the window, and can't break it. Can't break it. That's three. Four. If you're counting at home, that's 14 blows against the window with the mop. Now remember, the dirty part of the mop is underneath his arm. He's got a hat. Again, he strikes the window. And now he comes down hard, raining blows down upon the window. One, two, three, and this is just about tuckered him out. He decides to run over to the other window, thinking maybe that one will be a little easier to break with a mop handle, but no. Now he's moving away from the car and starting to get a second plan. This time he starts to climb up onto a rooftop. He still has the mop in his left hand. He places the mop on top of a roof, and now he starts to think about whether or not he wants to climb up. He places his right foot on top of the wall. Here he comes, and he falls off the wall. Oh my God, somebody get some salami and cream cheese and rub it all over his face. He's unconscious on the ground with the mop. That's the story.
Wow.
Why salami and cream cheese? I don't know.
Wow.
But I'm here for mocking that dude. He literally was trying to like break into like a Ford 250 with like a fucking dirty mop. like a wooden dirty mop. Anyway, what's this about travel warnings?
Yeah, so there's, you know, ever since Tupac Fiasco took over and shit has been going left here, you know, tiki torches in the streets and things like this. There's been a series of warnings about travel to the U.S. have been issued by overseas governments. And so...
makes perfect sense.
Yeah, so government travel advisories have been issued from the UAE, the Bahamas, France, the U.K., Canada, New Zealand, and Germany are among those urging caution to U.S.-bound travelers. Their concerns include mass shootings, police violence, anti-Muslim and anti-LGBT attitudes, and the Zika virus. While it's too soon to determine if these warnings are hurting U.S. tourism, the warnings tarnish the image of the U.S. Promotes as a country that prides itself as a welcoming society, blah, 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 which we all know is bullshit. Countries such as the UK have added the US, the state of Florida in particular, to the list of countries where travelers face a moderate risk of catching the Zika virus. Interesting. The French government travel advice website informs citizens that it is legal for many Americans to carry firearms. Germany warns it is relatively easy to obtain a firearm in the U.S. If you find yourself the victim of a gun attack, do not resist.
Oh, my God. They both are talking about guns.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And there's, you know, it was in, I think it was like the 90s where there was a couple of high-profile attacks on Japanese tourists in the Miami area, and they literally like stopped issuing tourist visas. They said people shouldn't go to Florida, and it was like a big deal. Like tourism dollars were definitely lost. There's no way this is not impacting in some way. I don't know which convention Visitors Bureau is feeling the pinch, but there's no way that's not having an impact. And they specifically cited Florida?
Yeah, specifically. So xenophobia is also another worry. A UAE released a travel advisory in July urging men not to wear traditional clothing after a citizen was tackled to the ground and injured by police in Ohio. Officers have been alerted by hotel staff who feared the businessman's robe and headscarf indicated terrorist intentions.
So just Sikh and Sunni Muslims are just, you know... They're just walking around looking like terrorists so you can tackle them to the ground.
In other countries, police shootings of two black men in Louisiana and Minnesota have sparked concern. In particular, this is from the Bahamas Foreign Ministry. In particular, young males are asked to exercise extreme caution in affected cities in their interactions with the police. Do not be confrontational and cooperate.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. The UAE and its Middle East neighbor Bahrain issued advisories after the Dallas shooting of those police officers. For your own safety, please stay away from any ongoing or planned demonstrations and protests in the cities of the United States. Please be aware of immediate surroundings and avoid crowded places when possible.
So. It doesn't surprise me, but that is just such a... Yep. You know, in tandem, our country's debt has been downgraded. Right? It's no longer like a AAA bond. Whatever it is, it's like AA or single A. I'm not saying it's ever going to be junk status, but it's going down. Like, people coming to this country are, you know, less and less because of shit like this. Good Lord. All our news kind of sucks. It's always kind of like shitty, but.
I mean, news is news.
News is news.
What else?
White River Junction, former South Royalton School Principal Dean Stearns, balding white guy, alleged to have surreptitiously recorded a total of 5 girls under the age of 18 during stays at his Sharon home based on Vermont State Police analysis of several electronic devices found inside the residence. Stearns now faces charged with 6 felony counts of promoting sexual recordings, 30 misdemeanor counts of voyeurism. He's pleaded not guilty to all the charges. His arraignment Monday, blah, 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 blah. Prosecutors charged Stearns with 1 count each of promoting a sexual recording and voyeurism, accusing him of recording a girl inside her bedroom and bathroom while she was staying in his home. Investigation allegations concluded Monday. Announced found evidence of 4 additional victims that were also guests in his home. Recovered a total of 205 pictures and videos depicting partially or fully nude teenage girls as they changed, showered, and used the bathroom in Stearns' home. According to Vermont police, the media files are contained on a variety of devices seized from Stearns' home, including devices that resembled a cell phone charger, an alarm clock, a nightlight bulb, and all had been hidden cameras embedded in them. A cell charger, an alarm clock, and a nightlight that all had hidden recorders in them. And that was actually what tipped off the police. One of the devices, a fake charger. A girl told Stearns, 56, gave her the charger to use in her bathroom inside his home. She realized it didn't work. She unplugged it and left it on the counter, only to return later to see it was plugged back into the wall. According to the affidavit, suspicious, she examined the charger and found the hidden camera, prompting her to eventually tell an adult. She believed Stearns was been spying on her since the summer. We should put this in a section under education.
You know, is that what that is?
Just so many educators. It's just the entire education system, and I should say entire, but it is one of the most steeped in supremacy and bullshit institutions education is, but I'm trying to go down and see if this guy's on suspension.
Is he? I doubt it.
It's everything that Ms. Stearns has been charged with took place outside of the school and outside of school hours. I will be working along with our administrators and school counselors to continue to provide support to our students, faculty, and staff that are affected by his actions by making several counselors available. As a community, we'll continue to respond to the impact of these charges. We are a strong, compassionate, and resilient community with a history of caring response to challenge on behalf of our children. Before he released Stearns on Monday. No, it doesn't say anything about his employment. I'm sure he's still keeping his job. Certainly his pension, his pay. If the school's comment is, this happened off school grounds and after school hours, you know, but we're gonna participate in a full investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Stearns resigned from his job as principal in October. Oh, okay. Amid complaints from teachers about a stressful workplace climate at the school. Decision that followed an approved merger between Royalton and Bethel school districts. Resignation letter to the Royalton school board at the time. He cited personal and professional reasons. That resignation was set to take effect in June. Mm. Oh, for crying out loud. So he resigned back in October. He knew the police investigation was coming.
He knew that shit was coming.
And it takes effect in June.
Come on.
It's always that way. Like, the guillotine's coming. Let me get my golden parachute and dip out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Anywho. Next.
Next up, we have, this is also terrible, actually, but a black Muslim firefighter endured years of racist and religious harassment. When he spoke up, he was arrested. This is from theroot.com. Another day, another accusation of racism against New York City's fire department. In a lawsuit filed Tuesday in federal court in Brooklyn, a black Muslim firefighter says he was punished by the department for speaking out about the harassment he has endured for 12 years over his race and religion. Rasheen Hassan, a Navy veteran and firefighter, says he was subjected to racial and religious abuse by his fellow firefighters at his firehouse in Brooklyn, Flatland section. Hassan's suit says he was asked to apologize for 9/11 because of his Muslim background. He says he also began skipping group meals at the firehouse because his coworkers, quote, tried to slip pork or pork byproducts into his food, end quote. As you know, pork is considered haram or prohibited in Muslim religious practice. Then there was the racist harassment. Hassan said he was referred to by racial slurs, and one of his coworkers was told by one of his coworkers that black firefighters are lazy and no one wants to work with them. Court papers also indicate that his coworkers would bleach his clothes and throw water on him from the top of the firehouse. In addition, according to court filings in a group chat for firefighters and the firehouse supervisors, Hassan was repeatedly told he wasn't welcome and should transfer and was referred to as a rat.
I'm not surprised at all.
Hassan's abuse then could not have been a surprise to his supervisors when he brought his complaints to their attention. But, says Hassan, his supervisor, instead of disciplining the harassers, in December brought false charges against the firefighter, which led to his arrest.
Mm-hmm. What were the charges?
The supervisor claimed that Hassan threatened to, quote, kill the guys in the firehouse, an allegation Hassan vehemently denies. It wasn't until a Daily News article outlined the years of abuse that against Hassan, that officials of the FDNY took action against his harassers, transferring firefighters and their supervisors out of the firehouse. Hassan's suit mirrors others launched against the FDNY, the nation's largest fire department. And the systemic harassment wasn't isolated to the one firehouse, but is an ongoing and rampant problem within the entire department. His lawyer says the entrenched racism within his organization is a disease.
Oh, my God. It's got to be awful. We have I have a friend, a former colleague that really is trying to be a firefighter. And at various intervals has not, as a volunteer working in different departments, hasn't necessarily fit in with that department's like fraternity. Cause it really is. It's like a frat house, right? Like you're either part of the club or you're not at a lot of these places.
Facts.
And when this individual, white male, didn't fit in for whatever variety of reasons, it was awful. It was like miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying to him, like, but you want to go do this as like a profession and you don't know what department you're going to get signed and whether you're going to fit in with that culture or not. And if you don't, good fucking luck, you know?
It's true. Good luck. And it is just like a frat house, and that's how they pretty much treat everything for the most part. It's just kind of like,
oh, and we've,
that's it.
We've talked at least on three different episodes of the John about fraternities being racist as fuck, like chanting the N-word and like singing like songs with racist verses. Fraternities, yes. You know, we know how they go. Mm-hmm. And we've had at least two different discussions on this podcast in the years past about racism against black people in both the fire and police department. One where they were getting like little death threats and shit, like written in their locker. They'd show up and be like, you know, N word, die, we're going to kill you, blah, 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 blah.
All of the above.
Yeah.
I don't.
Sweet.
Yeah, it's definitely not cool.
Fucking white people. So,
yeah. I couldn't put that into white people because it wasn't like all white people.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
You got the wrong.
Got the wrong link?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. It says. This is the do not congratulate stuff, but I wanted to talk about Claire's filing for bankruptcy. Oh, yeah. And
I'll find it while you're talking about
it. I don't need the link. It doesn't matter. I just thought a couple things. One, it was like iconic in my mind. Claire's and the mall was just like hand in hand, right? Like, not, I don't know if you still went to Claire's when you were, if it was still around when you were going to mall and you buy like costume jewelry at Claire's, but like, I just remember always seeing Claire's. And then the thing that got me was that they filed bankruptcy with like, and you have to pull it up now. Find it.
I am
it $2 or $6 billion in debt. That's all I want to know is how much the debt they had.
Claire's, which says it has pierced more than 100 million ears around the world, everybody, reached a restructuring agreement with its creditors in a Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing on Monday. Claire's said it would reduce its debt by $1.9 billion. It had held $2.1 billion in debt at the end of 2017.
I just, and for me, I was like, how do you...
I wonder if they hired... Never mind.
How do you fucking get... Yeah, don't do that. How do you get two fucking billion? You're so petty.
I'm
so
shady, y'all. Anyways, whatever.
That's their expertise.
Sure is.
Big-ass people going in bankruptcy.
Yeah.
But how do you fucking get $2 billion in debt?
Yo, Claire's. When all you're selling is like knickknacks and trinkets.
$2 billion.
Too many damn stores is what it is. Well,
even if you read the article, I think they got bought by an equity firm, like one of these private equity firms trying to like...
Yeah, Apollo Management, a private equity firm, bought it for $3.1 billion and took the company private in what's known as a leveraged buyout. But it could never escape it. That was in 2007, but it could never escape its debt load as traffic slowed to its brick and mortar stores, shoppers moved to digital channels, and fast fashion chains such as H&M, Zara, and Forever 21 chipped away at sales. Claire's joins a long line of retailers who have filed for bankruptcy in recent years. Obviously, everybody's been talking about Toys R Us, but also Payless Shoes, Gymboree, Rue 21, The Limited, and Radio Shack also filed bankruptcy recently.
Yeah, a lot of things are getting shut down. Jeff Bezos is
And this bankruptcy is not closing the stores. I just want to be clear. Like, Toys R Us went out of business. This is not what's happening with Claire's.
No, they're restructuring the debt.
Yeah, so they hope that a lighter balance sheet will help them avoid the fate of Toys R Us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's just like somebody who they bought claim their debt.
That they're Amazon proof because you can't pierce your ears online.
You know, they said over 100 million years and they had $2 billion in debt. That's $20 an ear.
Wow.
That's not really a good, like... Okay, you had 100 million years, but you also had $20 in debt for every one of those years you pierced.
Facts.
I'm sorry, you're not running your business very effectively.
No, you are not.
And that's like sometimes the whole like too big to fail, this, that, the other thing. Bankruptcy is definitely the provenance of like the privilege and white folk and shit. But I just like the company you worked for when they went bankrupt, the first thing they did was set aside like $8 million for executive pays and bonuses and shit. Mm-hmm. Under the theory that if we don't, they're going to leave during the bankruptcy restructuring and we won't be able to sell the company. And they did sell some of the units of the company.
Right.
But it boggled my mind. Like, you're in like the sales department, you're management. And like, yeah, they set aside this. And then when you got the check, I was like, no fucking way. How much are they giving you?
Yeah.
They went bankrupt. They're giving you how much money? What the fuck?
Yeah, it was pretty.
You weren't even one of these like big wig muggity mugs, like a regional director. Like, honest to God, like the first thing out of bankruptcy was $8 million for executives. It's like, fuck you.
Yeah.
Fuck you.
It was pretty, yeah. But I mean, I do understand on one side of things, because like their whole thing is when you're going into bankruptcy, you don't want the people that are actually bringing in the money to go away. But I do think it's kind of like shady.
Oh, you okay?
Yeah, just dropping shit.
Nothing liquid?
No. Okay. I think I broke something, though.
Oh, no. What'd you break?
That's fine. I don't know how I broke it, though. Anyways, nobody wants to hear about me talking about how I broke something.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. I broke something. Yeah,
Alfred Woodard, you broke your little ships.
You broke your little ships. So, also, you know, the... president and Michelle Obama's portraits are now hanging in the, well, their national portrait gallery portraits, not their official White House portraits, are now up and people can go and see them. There's been quite a few stories about, you know, just how popular they've been and also just like, you know, just lines to go and see it. Yeah. A few friends I might have gone to see it. I'll definitely be checking out next time I'm in D.C., which I think will be probably in the fall. But Michelle Obama was so popular, she needed more space. The distinctive Amy Sherrill painting of the former First Lady unveiled at the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery last month has been relocated to a different part of the museum due to demand. Quote, we're always changing things up here due to the high volume of visitors. We've relocated Michelle Obama's portrait to the third floor in our 20th Century Americans Gallery for a more spacious viewing experience. Because literally people were showing pictures and it like legit looked like people going to see the Mona Lisa, like the number of people like huddled around this one little spot. The museum has been inundated with visitors since the portraits of the Obamas were unveiled. 176,700 people visited the gallery in February 2018, its biggest month in 3 years per Smithsonian Institute data. Last weekend, nearly 45,000 visitors stopped by from Thursday to Sunday alone.
Say that again.
Last weekend, nearly 45,000 visitors stopped by from Thursday to Sunday alone. I think two things that help specifically about
that's like a thousand an
about
hour.
Michelle Obama's portrait is that Amy Sherrill is from Baltimore and she's very like big there, like okay. people know her. So and it's so close. I know a lot of people are coming up to see this particular portrait because it's a hometown artist and you know that kind of connection. And also the other thing is that. Yeah, just I think it's really interesting to see how many people are going to see this. Quite a few groups that went to see the DC Wrinkle in Time Challenge screening went to see the portrait right before the movie. So they all went, they went to the movie. I mean, they went to see the portraits and then they came to see the movie. They were really like all hyped up after.
I feel there's definitely a little bit of like things are so bad that there's definitely a little
bit of like any little bit of like bright hope that you can remember like when things weren't quite this shitty and you were, you know, in my, from my perspective anyways, you were, you know, your adversaries were at least rational people. Yeah, like
I wax philosophical about the days of George W. Bush.
I don't know if I wax that philosophically, but that's taking it too far.
Roe and Bush were horrible, but again, they were very clear who they were. You knew what you were fucking up against. They didn't fucking like, I don't know. Doesn't matter. They both kind of sucked. But
yeah, exactly.
Craigslist. So, they're
shutting
down.
I know you wanted to talk about this.
Yeah, I saw a bunch of people. I follow a whole lot of folk, and in particular, some that are very sex positive, and including sex workers by choice. And specifically, there was the bill, H.R. 1865, is an anti-online sex trafficking bill, has potential to put harm to consenting adult sex workers. In response, Craigslist has shuttered its entire personal section, even platonic ones. Early Friday morning, so the bill was passed Thursday 72-2, so like overwhelming, like, you know, majority. And right away, Friday morning, Craigslist made a public post regarding the bill, commonly known as FOSTA, Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act, that explained the logic behind their decision to shut down one of the most widely used subsections of the platform. The message was straight and to the point. This is from Craigslist. U.S. Congress just passed H.R. 1865, FOSTA, seeking to subject websites to criminal and civil liability when third parties, users, misuse online personals unlawfully. Any tool service can be misused. We can't take such risk without jeopardizing all of our other services, so we are regretfully taking Craigslist personals offline. Hopefully we can bring them back someday. To the millions of spouses, partners, and couples who met through Craigslist, wish you every happiness. In a post-FOSTA world, websites like Craigslist where sex workers commonly post ads for their services would be legally responsible for the whatever kinds of illegal interactions users ultimately took part in. And I'll just go sidebar. I this concept of a website or internet hosting provider being not liable for what people do on the website is like, I don't say it's like a central tenet to the internet, but like a lot of things won't exist now that this is a law, if that makes sense.
Right.
And I think things that haven't stopped existing are going to have to be considered. Like Reddit put a couple subreddits down right away. I don't know what the subreddit was, but it was certainly, I bet you it was something like Backpage, right?
Like, yeah, probably was something like that.
You know, but they took it down right away. And and they said that. The other thing that someone on Twitter that I said was a sex positive, and again, forgive me, I forget the language about sex workers that are sex workers by choice, but that regardless of why you're a sex worker, being able to like pre-screen your clientele of some sort, I guess what you call it, reduce the risk of homicide by like 20%. So, you know, I know they're trying, I know the purpose, stop, and I'm all for stopping child sex trafficking. And absolutely, some of these utilities are used for people by choice and other people by not by choice, right? Via sex trafficking. But I don't know. I think the implication of making websites criminally and civilly liable for behavior that takes place is, I don't know the ramifications of that.
Right.
And I think that's, it feels broad reaching, you know, like the, what was the one after 9/11?
Yeah, the Patriot Act.
The Patriot Act.
Yeah, you know? I mean, it does feel like that. It feels like where you're, like, to me, it's never actually addressing the situation that they're trying to harm. It's kind of like this, like, backwards way of addressing the symptom and not the root cause. Yeah. And so I don't really understand the purpose of it.
And
I don't buy this whole, like, oh, you know, in some instances, like, yes, do less harm. But in this, it's like, nah, like, we need to be really cognizant because the other part of that, like, do less harm only works if the thing you're enacting doesn't cause harm to other folks, right? Whereas I feel like this will actually do the opposite.
I agree with you, and I'm wondering, like, what you said about the symptom and root cause, and frequently when there's legislation to, like, moderate or change people's behavior, I'm not certain it does more than it shifts it to somewhere else. You know, and I'm not saying this will or won't. I don't know. I hope it does reduce child sex trafficking. I really do. I suspect those that engage in that will find a way to engage in it in darker portions of the web.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I could be wrong. I don't know. But, yeah. And again, I speak as someone who works for a website that's in a completely banal, not at all related industry, but has forums with thousands and thousands of people using them. And some of these forums aren't exactly moderated. And it's like, I don't know what the implications
are. They're just like, whatever.
Yeah, I don't know what the implications are.
Don't know what the implications are either. And it's interesting that you put it in that particular, like, you know.
What if you have a forum and it's not meant for sex trafficking, but somebody comes in and puts something on there? You really, like, are you going to have to moderate and read every post now? Like, that if you have to moderate and read every post on a forum, fucking no forums would exist.
Right.
Like, Wikipedia wouldn't exist.
No, Wikipedia definitely wouldn't exist.
And there's some argument that this might, like, so people that got funded wouldn't get funding now because the legal ramifications are too big. Like Wikipedia got money at some point, like WikiCommons, whatever it was. And maybe people are like, no, I'm not going to give money to Wikipedia because I think the, you know, one lawsuit and you're fucked.
You're fucked, right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I guess that's true.
Again, I don't know. We'll see. I've seen both sides of the story, but I, on my timeline, saw people talking about the impact on.
Yeah, I think the impact is definitely the, like, most important thing to think through.
Okay. I just saw this headline.
So the last thing I want to mention, I put it up here because I was like, oh, wait a second. Like, Drew is going to want to talk about this.
I just want to hear it. Tell me.
Hear about it. It's from BBC. So this is a UK-based story that's coming through. But RAC says new headlights are blinding drivers. Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Drivers are being temporarily blinded by modern vehicle headlights, according to an RAC survey. Two-thirds of drivers say they are regularly dazzled by oncoming headlights, even though they are dipped, which means they're lowered in UK speak. The survey, it's low beams, but still they're having problems with the eyesight. And 67% of those said it can take up to 5 seconds for their sight to clear, with a further 10% claiming the effect on their eyes lasts up to 10 seconds. The REC says advances in headlight technology are causing the problem. About 15% of those drivers polled said they had nearly suffered a collision as a result of being dazzled by other drivers using full beam headlights. REC spokesman Pete Williams said, quote, "The intensity and brightness of some new car headlights is clearly causing difficulty for other road users. Headlight technology has advanced considerably in recent years." This is still him talking.
Yeah, yeah.
But while that may be better for the drivers of those particular vehicles, it's presenting an unwanted new road safety risk for anyone driving towards them or even trying to pull out of at a junction. All cars sold for road use in the UK have to be fitted with headlamps that conform to standards by the EU, in line with the UN's World Forum for Harmonization of Vehicle Regulations. A UN working party is currently looking at the issue of headlight glare with its next meeting, due due to be held at the end of the month. So,
listen, I bitch about this all the time.
Constantly.
But I had LASIK, and one of the side effects of LASIK surgery is sort of like night vision issues, sensitivity to light, halos and whatnot. But I joking about it, but our car's one of these cars. Like when we first got it, we called it the spaceship for a reason. It's got like the regular ass xenon headlights, and then it's got the fog lights. And if you run in with just the fog lights and the xenon whatever lights, fucking lights up everything. And I'm sure from the other direction, our car is just as irritating. And I feel like that whenever, you know, relatively, like you said, newer, you know, used to be more high end, but now just like fucking Altima comes down, you're like, what the fuck? Jesus. Yep. That's a lot of lights coming out that Altima.
It really is crazy.
And the back lights too. Like the rear lights, I find give like a hypnotic weird effect when they're all the LED Johns.
Mm-hmm.
But that, on the back lights, it makes, I don't say more sense, but, and I didn't know this till someone told me, but LED lighting, it illuminates faster than like a traditional light bulb. So like old style brake light was a regular old light bulb. Maybe it was a red light bulb, but even a regular old light bulb behind a red plastic piece, right? And to illuminate an incandescent light bulb takes whatever nanoseconds, but to illuminate a LED's like X nanoseconds faster, and at 60 miles an hour, that equals like 4 or 5 feet of braking distance. So they have a very specific purpose, but I find those brake lights like I say, hypnotic. The combination of the brake lights.
And I feel
the
like it definitely affects different people differently, but I will say that these newer lights, like they'll just dance on you and you'll just be like, whoa, what the fuck just happened?
Like, on the highway when I'm following like, a car with these red lights, I'm like,
there's
whoa.
Like, boop, 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 boop. It's like a cartoon. It's terrible.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And our headlights, I haven't replaced one ever. Mm. It's a decade and like damn near 100,000 miles and I've never replaced it.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably gotten dimmer, but. That says
still working,
the,
right?
I just said that says something about the power and durability of these new headlights.
Facts.
It's like,
our car isn't even new, but whatever.
No, but I remember when we first got it, I was like checking it out and like looking at it from like other angles. I'd be like, oh my God, it looks like a fucking spaceship. Because the lights were just like everywhere.
Just cuckoo.
Yeah. I love it.
Yo,
I fucking love
it.
It doesn't
want
to do it. It doesn't want to do
like,
it.
Like, fuck you.
No, we're not going to play the cops.
So I'm not even going to. This is a really long article. It's in the New York Times this week. It's called Test the Lying by Police, a Stubborn Problem. And really, like, it details the consistency of it's a kind of a collection of a series of articles specifically addressing NYPD's inappropriate lying on the stand when it comes to actually prosecuting the quote unquote criminals that they arrest. So they even have a name for it. It's called Test the Lying. I'll just read this first one, which is Officer Nectar Martinez took the witness stand in a Bronx courtroom on October 10th, 2017 and swore to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help him God. There had been a shooting. Officer Martinez testified and he wanted to search a nearby apartment for evidence. A woman stood in the doorway carrying a laundry bag. Officer Martinez says she set the bag down in the middle of the doorway directly in his path. I picked it up to move it out of the way so I could get in. The laundry bag felt heavy. He put it down. He said he heard a clunk. A thud. What might be inside? Officer Martinez tapped the bag with his foot and felt something hard. He testified. He opened the bag, leading to the discovery of a Ruger 9mm handgun, and arrested the woman. But a hallway surveillance camera captured the true story. There's no laundry bag or gun in sight as Officer Ramirez and other investigators question the woman in the doorway and then stride into the apartment. Inside, they did find a gun, but little to link it to the woman, Kimberly Thomas. Still, had the camera not captured the hallway scene, Officer Martinez's testimony might well have sent her to prison. Mm-hmm. Literally, just made it up.
They call it test-a-lying.
Behind closed doors, we call it test-a-lying, a New York City police officer, Pedro Serrano, said in an interview, echoing a word that officers coined at least 25 years ago. You take the truth and you stretch it out a little bit. An investigation by the New York Times has found that on more than 25 occasions since January 2015, judges or prosecutors determined that a key aspect of the New York City police officer's testimony was probably untrue. This is just the shit that the judge and the prosecutor found out about
in the last like month and a bit.
No, January 2015. So it's been a couple years. But again, these are the ones that they were caught Tesla lying, okay? The Times identified these cases, many of which are sealed, through interviews with lawyers, police officers, and current and former judges. In these cases, officers have lied about the whereabouts of guns, putting them in suspects' hands or waistbands when they were actually hidden out of sight. They have barged into apartments and conducted searches only to testify otherwise later. Under oath, they have given firsthand accounts of crimes or arrests that they did not, in fact, witness. They have falsely claimed to have watched drug deals happen only to later recant or be shown to be lying. Mm-hmm. No detail seemingly is too minor to be embellished. Clenched fist is how one Brooklyn officer described the hands of a man he claimed had angrily approached him and started yelling and screaming, an encounter that prosecutors later deemed never occurred. Another officer during a Bronx trial accused a driver of recklessly crossing a double line on a stretch of road that has no double yellow line. In many instances, the motives were lying were readily apparent. To skirt constitutional restrictions against unreasonable searches and stops. In other cases, the falsehoods appear aimed at convicting people who may or may not have committed a crime with trumped up evidence. In still others, the motive is not easy to discern. In October 2016, for example, Plainclothes Brooklyn officer gave a grand jury a first person account of a gun arrest. Putting herself in the center of the action, the officer, Dorinza Agard, testified that she had approached a man to confront him for littering. He suddenly crouched behind a van, pulled from his waistband a dark object, later identified as a gun, and threw it on the ground. P.O. Agard testified that she had heard a large metal object hit the ground, according to a letter the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office wrote summarizing her testimony. But prosecutors lost faith in her account in July after learning from another officer that she was not among the first officers on the scene. Agard had arrived later as backup, according to the letter, which noted that the gun charges against the man were later dismissed. The prosecutor did not address why Agard claimed to be a witness or why the other officers present seemed to have allowed her to process the arrest. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I talk with white people a lot. And those even in my life, sometimes they get it, but don't totally get it. And I try to use the judiciary system, but even more than just like cops killing people. But there's a point, multiple points where there's discretion, right? Mm-hmm. The officer has discretion as to what they're going to charge you with, what they're going to collect as evidence, what they're going to turn in, what they're going to say. They have discretion as to what they're going to say to the media. Frequently, they say firsthand accounts, like we're hearing that, you know, this happened, that happened. You weren't even there, but they talk about it in a sort of, you know, objective sort of way, but it's very subjective. There's discretion on the prosecutor, how and what they charge you with, the judge. And now we're hearing that not there's discretion, but the police are taking it upon themselves to lie, you know, and like they're not doing that on white cases. Or if they are, we know we're not arresting nearly as many white assailants, right? Mm. And, you know, if you're going to trump up and lie, almost certain it's going to be a person of color, right? You know, like I don't know how many of these 200 rubber cases, if someone wanted to do the analysis, guarantee it's 80%+ black people that are being mm-hmm. fucked with in this way. And it's just one of those points where it's like, you know, it's, I don't call it unbelievable, but that's the system working, you know? Like, and then what was the problem here? None of these cops got suspended. None. Got fired.
Well, that's the thing. They mentioned in the article also, no fear of being caught. Many police officers and experts express optimism that the prevalence of cameras will reduce police lying. As officers begin to accept that digital evidence of an encounter will emerge, lying will be perceived as too risky, or so the thinking goes. Basically, it's harder for a cop to lie today. The police department's top legal official, Lawrence Burns, said it last year at a New York City Bar Association event, noting that there were millions of cell phones on the street, blah, blah, blah. As more police encounters are recorded, whether on the cell phones of bystanders or the body-worn cameras of the officers, false police testimony is being exposed in cases where the officer's word might have carried the day. This is true for run-of-the-mill drug cases as well as for police shootings so notorious that they are being seared into the national consciousness. Yet, interviews with officers suggest that the prevalence of cameras alone won't end police lying. That's because shocking. Even with cameras present, some officers figure, with good reason, that a lie is unlikely to be exposed. Because plea deals are a typical outcome, it's rare for a case to develop to the point where a defendant can question an officer's version of events at a hearing. One officer, a Brooklyn officer, said, who'd been in the force for roughly a decade, said there's no fear of being caught. You're not going to go to trial and nobody's going to be cross-examined.
Did we talk on this show about a lack of trial jurors, in particular in rural areas? Was that on the show or no?
I don't remember.
Yeah, it's not somewhat unrelated, but so like 98% of cases are getting settled before they go to trial. So there's a dearth. There's not a lot of experienced trial lawyers, and people want someone who has trial experience. I'm not going to hire a rookie, right? Like, I'm going to trial. Like, I want someone who's been a lawyer at multiple jury trials before, right? There's like, I don't want to just hire like any schmuck off the street. I want to get like the right person. So now people that want to be jury attorneys for jury trials don't get any kind of practice. Mm-hmm. They don't have anything. And then this is somewhat related. There's a lack of lawyers in really rural areas, and we're included. North Carolina's got one of the lowest lawyer to people ratios.
Yeah.
And it's in particular rural areas where it's very difficult. And I'm certain that the very nexus intersection of that is public defenders for black and brown people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're saying, like, hey, there's a shortage of lawyers in rural Macon, Georgia, and cops are lying on the stand, do the math.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow. Yeah. I didn't. That was supposed to be my story. You read it.
But oh, I'm sorry. That's okay. That's all right. Didn't know that.
You see the color coding. It's all good. But I don't have these other stories up.
All right. Well, I'll keep talking then about trash ass cops.
Please do.
So, tapes. Speaking of tapes, captured a New Jersey police chief making racist remarks. Now he's headed to trial on crime charges. When a hotel manager called 911, this is in the Philly Inquirer, to report that a disorderly guest was refusing to leave the pool and a responding officer requested backup, Bordentown Township Police Chief Frank Nucera Jr. Rushed to the scene on a rainy summer night. The chief joined a handful of patrolmen, including a canine officer and his barking dog, in answering the call in September 2016. Now, dash cam video, 911 tapes, and police logs obtained by the Inquirer and Daily News shed a fresh light on an encounter at the Bordentown Ramada Hotel that prosecutors say ended with a young man beaten while handcuffed, and that led to Nukera's resignation and eventual arrest on federal hate crime charges. Mm-hmm. Yes, he's already at the center. He's 61 years old. He's at the center of a hate crime case that rocked the small police department and made national headlines. Trash. He's expected to stand federal trial in court in Camden later this year, charged with the assault of Timothy Strone, then 18, of Trenton, and with the frequent use of racial epithets that were caught on tape. Mm-hmm. Authorities quoted Nucera saying blacks were, quote, like ISIS, they have no value, and that he wished he could join a firing squad to, quote, mow them down.
Jesus.
He had been police chief and town administrator since 2006, a decade. Also ordered police dogs to be deployed at high school basketball games to intimidate black spectators, authorities said. Officers in his police department, quote, saw what was going on, knew it was wrong, and had had enough and called the FBI. Listen. That's when you know it's bad.
When your own, you know, like the blue wall of silence literally called the FBI.
It's like, wait, this dude is sicking police dogs on children. Mm-hmm.
Well, there was, again, we've talked so many times about this on the show, but Yes All Cops. There was a cop that was like literally at his daily roll call was putting out like bounties on black people and like, you know, literally like how many black people can you pull over? Like, it's so rampant. So rampant. We, in St. Louis, the county where Ferguson was, they had more arrests than they did people. Fucking what are you talking about?
Yeah. Once news of the charges broke, residents demanded answers on how the chief's allegedly racist behavior went unnoticed and unreported for years in the predominantly white community of about 11,000, 40 miles northeast of Philadelphia. The township officials said they could not comment before the trial. Others were more vocal. Walter Hudson, who shout out to Walter, a civil rights activist of Penns Grove, founder of National Wear Alliance, says the chief operated in a rogue and racist manner. He did it with malice. This is the playbook of police brutality when it comes to black and brown people. John Shane, who is a CUNY associate professor of criminal justice, says you can be a bigot and be a cop.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
When the officer acts on it and takes some kind of force, and during the use of force, they're throwing on the N-word or calling someone a filthy Arab, then you have a problem.
Wait a minute. Whoa.
Only then,
so
though,
a bigoted cop is totally kosher? Is that no? Hey.
Non-bigoted cop, I guess, is cool.
He said you can be a cop and be bigoted.
No, he's saying that, like, it. Yeah, he's saying, like, I guess you can, as long as you don't beat people up and say the N-word. You can just beat them up. I don't really know.
It's just like when we joined the Unitarian Universalist group in our former home. The guy's like, well, you know, you use really great. You can be just about anything other than overtly racist.
What we did know is they meant that you could be covertly racist. That's totally fine.
You could be subtly racist.
Yes. The three officers radio in to say they were en route after the 6:53 p.m. call went out. The dispatcher waved up the force, saying we should be all right, and added that two other units had already arrived at the scene. Within minutes, yet another officer called in to report that they would be there momentarily. Soon, there was chaos, with officers running in different directions after they discovered there was no one in the pool. Where are you guys at? One asked, and the question was echoed by other officers in search of their colleagues and the reportedly disorderly guest. One or two canine dogs barked fiercely, adding to the sound of a pounding rain. Minutes earlier, Stroh and one of the first officers on the scene had gotten into a scuffle inside the hotel, leading to the call for backup. Police said Stroh resisted arrest, prompting the officer to pepper spray him and call for backup. The officer suffered a back injury in the tussle. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
He said that he recalls two of the four backup officers who approached him had their hands on their guns. I thought they were going to shoot me. After he was subdued and standing in the top of the stairwell in handcuffs, he said Nuquera struck him from behind. He said that he was reacting to by threatening to spit on the chief, who taunted him, saying, I'll uncuff you and then I'll see how tough you are. The charges against him were later against Troy were later dismissed. He declined further comment this week. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Philly Rizzo. It's not at all racist.
Yeah.
Although they got Larry Krasner. Hopefully he's going to do some.
Well,
some,
that's Philly. That wouldn't really affect these folks. I'm going to skip this last one.
I was going to ask you to do that. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah, we'll skip that.
White people, I get bullied in school. I can't wait till I'm a cop so I can bully you. White people.
Fucking white people. The hashtag UOCases hashtag created by a black woman and a friend of the show, Feminista Jones, hijacked to promote white female concert. Stop stealing black women's labor. Author and activist Feminista Jones created the UOCases hashtag and movement as a proactive measure to curb the rampant street harassment experienced by black women. But over the weekend, a Pennsylvania venue tweeted out the hashtag on a flyer featuring five non-black women. The promotional material was a fundraising concert that would benefit a local domestic violence center. Jones is, of course, an advocate for women in domestic violence situations receiving assistance, but she has been very straightforward about how she wants the hashtag to be used. So folks, this is a quoting Feminista. I want to be clear. A lot of folks have used the tag and talked to me about it, and it's love. They, one, don't use it to raise money. Two, center black women. That's all I ask. I'm not asking too much, she posted on Twitter. Many of our friends also weighed in on it.
This group did neither of those things, by the way.
Yes, they did none of those things. And I just wanted to read, because she's already deleted it, the woman who is in charge of this.
Oh, they responded and deleted, huh?
Yeah, they replied when the tweets went up, because of course people then went to the page of the event and started commenting there, and she was feeling very quote-unquote attacked, because, you know, that's what happens.
Is there a way to, like, audible eye roll?
I don't know. I might need the like background music for me to read this bullshit.
Hold on, I'm gonna get you.
Let me find it. Oh, here it is. Her name is Diane Hall, and Diane says, "I just opened." Hold on, I gotta put my white woman voice in. I just opened up Facebook to find a barrage of verbal attacks concerning my fundraising concert for Turning Point. I'm completely blown away by this. I've been accused of quote unquote stealing the hashtag UOCases. And as I interpret the comments, capitalizing on, quote, someone else's movement. First of all, I've also been a victim of street harassment many times as a woman, regardless of the color of my skin. Second of all, I originally searched for the hashtag MeToo, but continued to look for an alternative. Several hashtags about sharing stories of sexual violence were in use before MeToo became the most popular. Hashtag My Harvey Weinstein, hashtag UOCases, hashtag What Were You Wearing, hashtag Survivor Privilege are prominent examples. Wikipedia. Third, I thought we were all in this together. In addition to the accusation of stealing the name of the event, I've also been accused of not including any black women in the lineup. While I don't have to explain myself to a complete stranger, in fact, I invited several women of color to be included in this event. They were either unavailable, uninterested, or unresponsive. I sincerely apologize for any misinterpretation that has happened here. If you read this with an open mind, I didn't steal anything. In fact, I'm giving credit to Feminista Jones by referencing the article in the post below. I'm trying to raise awareness for her work and the work of organizations that support women who have been sexually harassed and or abused. This topic is far too important to accuse me of anything untoward. I have replied to a few of the comments, but I will not engage in a war of words. If I have to change the name of the event, I will, but I sure hope it doesn't mean that we won't be raising money for Turning Point. Dina.
Wow. And that she deleted that, I assume.
Yeah, she has since deleted. Because she posted, people were like, outrageous. Bitch, are you serious? First of all, I want to know do you know who Feminista is? Like, what the fuck are you going to do for her? Who are you? Nobody even heard of you till you stole this black woman's work. Trash. And most, this is the thing that really got me fucking hot under the collar. This whole, like, well, I invited some women of color and they said no. Bitch, why don't you think about why they said no? Why you couldn't get somebody who was not white to come and play their little banjo for your bullshit ass concert? Cause you're trash.
What was the, like, I searched Me Too? Like, what was that even for?
That was just, she was just looking up hashtag. That was from Wikipedia. That whole paragraph was straight copied from Wikipedia. Because that's where we want to go for information.
I just don't see how that's a defense of your action. And then she's like, if I have to change it, I will. But you haven't yet.
If.
Change it.
If.
Young lady.
Bitch, yes. Change it.
Honestly, I heard Junior, was it 3 years ago, talk about white consumption of blackness and reference it as necromancy. Mm-hmm. And I literally was like, jeez, man, that's fucking extreme. Like, dance around in the skins of black people and shit. Like, what the fuck? That's crazy. Like, excuse me for being ableist, but like, wow, that's unbelievable. And then I see shit like this and hear shit like this, and necromancy is the only word, man. Like, white people, we just love to fucking consume blackness wantonly. And then we consume it. It's unbelievable. Yep. It's just gross. And unabashedly. You know, like, yeah, I fucking stole this shit, whatever. And all up and down the spectrum. Wasn't it the Jenner kids that had the fucking clothes with like Biggie lyrics and his face and shit?
Yep, it was.
It's like, you didn't even like ask the estate. Nope. You didn't even fucking like, you did nothing. You just fucking went to wherever and printed a bunch of these things and thought it was gonna like fly.
Yep.
Fuck, what the fuck?
I guess that's the way white people do. Anyways, that's your people.
Well, and we don't have any here but Diplo.
I have him under music, so we can talk about that. Yeah, I have him later when we talk about TV music and all that stuff. I have a few things in there. The show is nowhere near over, folks. But now comes my favorite segment.
We gotta get some music.
Music now, so I don't know what it's gonna be.
Well, people, someone write in and give us music for
Yum or Onion.
And it should be something stupid and kind of like, you know, like Benny Hill.
Well, just pick that then if that's what you want it to be.
I don't know. Something. But all right.
Anyways, are you ready?
I say like it's truth every time and I get wrong. I've got to get one of the onions right this time.
Okay. Here we go.
Okay.
The White House just keeps not telling the truth over and over and over again.
That's true as shit.
Okay. That's true.
There's enough.
Let's see. Exhausted Mueller trying to find Trump Organization Russia documents amid thousands of harassment lawsuits.
Exhausted Mueller. Thousands?
Mm-hmm.
Onion.
That's an onion. You
got it! Yeah! It was the thousands.
All right. Trump's opioid czar, Kellyanne Conway, has found the solution to the opioid crisis. Ice cream!
Wait a minute. Is Kellyanne Conway the opiate czar?
Know. Is she?
That's got to be onion.
It's true.
No, wait a minute. Kellyanne Conway's the opiate czar?
Yes.
When did that happen?
A while back.
Oh, good crap.
Mm-hmm.
And was her solution ice cream?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Our college campuses. You folks are reading the labels. They won't put any sugar in their body. They won't eat carbs anymore. And they're very fastidious about what goes into the body. And then you buy a street drug for $5 or $10. It's laced with fentanyl and that's it. Her advice? Eat the ice cream. Have the french fry. Don't buy the street drug. Believe me, it all works out. Anyways, let's keep moving on. RNC has spent more than $424,000, just so you're making sure you're saying yes or no to this one, at Trump property so far this year.
Oh, that's true as hell.
That is very true.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Trump advisors tell him, do not congratulate Putin. And he does anyway.
That's true.
That is true.
I saw that. That was everywhere.
Betsy.
Like, it didn't be clear. Like, they literally gave him the memo. It was like, you can do this thing. Just do not congratulate. It's the only thing. Don't say congratulations. First word out of his mouth. Congratulations.
Betsy DeVos argues issues of guns in schools should be fully left up to individual shooters.
Wait a minute. Issues it. Individual shooters.
Mm-hmm.
Say that again.
Betsy DeVos argues issue of guns in schools should be fully left up to individual shooters.
I can't. I'm really struggling to comport that sentence in my head, but I guess that's true. That's Union.
No, it's The Onion.
Oh, it sounded too.
Oh, but
crazy.
It sounds just like Betsy, though.
Well, that's. Saying. I know Betsy does some really outlandish stuff, like inviting like
she does.
Meninists to talk about stuff. So yeah, I kind of and I remember her saying something dumb about guns, but I should have known.
Everything
that
she says is dumb. Trump pushes death penalty for some drug dealers.
Oh, that's true. I read that.
That's very true. Let's horrible. See if we have any more here. Dozens of other countries that interfered in 2016 election annoyed Russia, getting all the credit.
That's Onion.
Yeah, that is. Let's see if we have any.
I like the concept that there were others meddling in the election. Man.
Trump moves closer to banning bump fire stocks.
I think that's true.
That is true. And the last one, Rick Perry apologizes for trying to outdo fellow cabinet members by using $72 million of taxpayer funds on lampshade.
Oh, that's Onion.
Yes, it is.
$72 million. The bump stocks, they need to go.
Yeah.
They've been prominent in all I shouldn't say this, but in the mass shootings when the death toll is like double digits, like 10 or more,
mm-hmm.
it's frequently a sporting rifle with a bump stock.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just I've fired one. It literally might as well be fully automatic.
Yep.
It's just, you know, it's bonkers. We have friends, you've done a podcast with Ricky from AUA, and he's ex-military. He'll be the first to tell you, like, this shit is not civilian weaponry. Like, what the entire fuck are we doing giving this to civilians? We shouldn't be.
Yeah, we definitely shouldn't be. So I wanted to, you know, we do lists here. I love a list.
Okay.
And so I ran across this list of the most iconic desserts in every state.
Ooh.
Which, you know, we love desserts.
Yeah, let's hear
some.
So
I don't know if you want to go through all of them or if we can just go through a few.
I want to see if I can guess them.
Okay, I'll guess.
Give me the dessert and see if I can guess the state.
No, I think that's going to be really hard to do because some of these are like rando.
Well, give me some states I've lived in and shit.
Some states you've lived in. Okay, here we go. Some states you've for sure lived in. Or just visited or lived in.
You cast a wide net.
Okay, here we go. How about... they're not in alphabetic order on this list, which is very strange. How about Hawaii? What do you think would be the national or the state most iconic dessert?
Something with pineapple. Upside down pineapple cake?
Shave ice is the... Shave ice. It's not your average snow cone. Delicate, melt-in-your-mouth flakes are shaved from large blocks of ice and topped with any and every fruit syrup. And sometimes with sweetened condensed milk as well. Let's see here. How about... I
never guessed that.
Yeah, that's a... I'm telling you, they're not really easy. How about Louisiana? That would be a little... We've lived there. Think about something that was invented in New
Orleans.
Thinking
maybe beignets.
What's been invented in New Orleans?
Beignet,
praline. There's a very like fancy dessert that's been invented there. Bananas Foster.
Oh, Banana Foster. Yeah, yep. Commander's Palace. I should have known that.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Kentucky has bread pudding with bourbon.
That makes sense,
right? Oklahoma is the fried pie. I might need to make a stop out there. That sounds good as hell. Let's see. Maryland has a Smith Island cake.
What's that even mean?
It's a small, they make big desserts. There's a Smith Island cake where 6 to 12 layers of yellow sponge cake with chocolate fudge frosting in between. Looks amazing.
6 layers of sponge? Mm-hmm. That sounds good as hell.
Sure does. The Hoosier sugar cream pie is the Indiana most famous dessert. It's made up of cream, sugar, and no eggs at all. So it's super rich.
All right, give me Illinois, Michigan, Pennsylvania.
All right, hold on, let me...
I know it's not alphabetical.
It isn't, so it's like hard for me to find everything. Jersey. How about Jersey?
Yeah, yeah. Water ice.
Saltwater taffy.
What?
Yes.
It's water ice. I guess that's going to be Pennsylvania.
All right, Michigan. This one you should get because of the fruit.
Moose tracks? No.
Nope.
Something cherry.
Yeah.
Cherry Jubilee?
Cherry pie. North Carolina, where we live now. A pie we don't, neither of us like. Sweet potato pie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Georgia, of course, another peach. Pie. Peach pie, of course. Ohio, actually, this one I did know, the Buckeye candy, of course. Pennsylvania, shoe fly pie.
See, I can't on that. But where's water ice? That's some bullshit.
Illinois?
I don't know. What is it on?
The Brownie.
Really?
Made their premiere appearance at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893. The original recipe calls a pound of chocolate and a pound of butter, so it's no wonder that the world fell in love with it. New York, of course, the cheesecake. Florida, you could guess that one.
No, I don't know why.
Key lime pie.
Oh, key lime pie.
Texas has pecan pie. Okay. Oh my God. Poor California. Frozen yogurt. Ooh.
Terrible. That's what you're known for? Yeah. That's iconic dessert.
That's iconic. Uh huh. So, anyways, I just thought that was a cute little thing. A few of them I thought were interesting. In Iowa, the Blarney Stone.
Yeah, I'm still stuck on New Jersey.
Because you're talking about Water Ice is a Philly thing. First off, it's not a Jersey thing.
All over the Jersey Shore,
It's all over the Philadelphia area. At the shore, it's not Water Ice everywhere. It's fucking taffy all over the place at the shore. I have to disagree with you on that. You're conflating the two, Philly and Jersey, because Jersey's a state. It's not just the Philadelphia area. So I'll have to disagree with you on that. I mean, you go past like South Jersey and nobody has Water Ice anywhere. These fried pies at Oklahoma look good, although Oklahoma, I don't know, Oklahoma. In Alabama, the Lane cake, which I've actually heard of as well. I always want to make one. It's a white cake lined with bourbon soaked raisins and coated with a snowy white marshmallow frosting. South Carolina has the Benny Wafers, which is a thin, crispy sesame cookie. Colorado has a Palisade Peach Cobbler, which is a little different than a traditional one. Minnesota has 7-layer bars. Let's see. Huckleberry Pie in Idaho. Molasses Cookies in West Virginia. Kolaches, which is a Czech treat in origin, is in Nebraska. Those look pretty good. Bizcochitos in New Mexico. It's a cinnamon and anise-flavored cookie. Chocolate fondue in Nevada. Random.
That's random.
Fondue. Peppernuts, which is a German. Oh, I know that. Pfeffernuss. It's a Christmas cookie from Germany, but they're very popular in Kansas, apparently. And they bake them all over there. Possum pie in Arkansas. There's no possums actually in it, but it has sweetened cream cheese, pecans, and chocolate pudding all hiding or playing possum beneath a heavenly layer of whipped cream.
Okay.
Mud pie from Mississippi, of course. Listen, Utah, I don't know about y'all, Utah. The Jell-O pretzel salad.
What the fuck is that?
It literally has like a pretzel like crust, and then there's like a cream in the middle, and then a Jell-O with fruit on the top. It just sounds horrible.
There's no black people in Utah.
None. The whoopie pie in New Hampshire. Blueberry pie, wild blueberry pie in Maine. Dough boys, which is a fried hunks of pizza dough topped with some sugar in Rhode Island. Sounds good to me. S'mores in Montana and strawberry shortcake in Delaware. So there you go.
Montana s'mores.
Yeah.
A little tick.
And Vermont has apple pie. So I guess they're the most American or whatever. I don't know.
Apple pie.
I thought that was interesting though.
So I saw you shared this with me.
Well, I shared it because, you know, we had talked about your boss doing this. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, you can say that. Yeah.
Using like black emojis all the time. He's using emojis all over the place.
Yeah, it's only on the one platform.
Right.
And I do think that there's a like select your skin color. And now that I'm reading this article, I'm going to have to ask him about it because I assume it's accidental, but it's definitely giving the wrong message. But someone wrote into Code Switch with the same sort of question/dilemma. So trying to pick the right emoji to convey exactly what you're feeling, excitement, fear, or existential dread, can be tough. What makes it more complicated? All those skin tones. On Ask Code Switch, we take on your trickiest question about race and identity. This week, we're taking a letter from, I won't say the name, 38 in Toronto. They write, my daughter, a very conscious 15-year-old queer white girl, has recently started using black hand emojis. We discuss race and politics all the time at home. She even listens to your podcast with me sometimes. We live in a diverse neighborhood of a diverse city. As a family and on her own, our daily lives include many friendships and interactions with people of color. So my question is, do I speak to her about using the emojis? Hey there, wave emoji. If your daughter's like me, she believes an emoji is worth 1,000 words. When a friend invites me over for dinner, I like to respond with a thumbs up. How else do you efficiently convey, yeah, what a great idea, I'm excited, but not too excited. Mm-hmm. The problem is the emoji you choose might be sending the wrong message. A text that reads as playful to one person might come off as insensitive to another. That's a different reason. A second. There are a lot of reasons your daughter might be using a black hand emoji. It sounds like she cares about the well-being of people of color around her, and she's probably not trying to cause offense. Maybe she feels that black hand emojis better convey what she's trying to communicate, or maybe she thinks using them is a good way to show solidarity with her friends of color. But therein lies the problem. When we step into the digital world, it's easy to feel like we can leave our IRL identities behind, but the power dynamics that exist in real life don't disappear because we're hidden behind a screen. So yes, you absolutely need to speak to your daughter about the implications of using emojis that don't match her racial identity, and the first step is to ask some simple questions. Question like, is her use of the emojis intentional or something she just happened to do one day, or says semantic injection? What are you trying to say that you can't say in the color of your own skin? And so yeah, my boss uses a skin tone darker than you, and it's like, the fuck?
Yeah, I don't.
And not like there's multiple platforms and communication devices, and it's only the one. And on that one, you do pick at some point. It's like, pick your tone, you know. And it, like, the default's like yellow, like Simpsons colored, you know. But I'm gonna hope and assume that the tone was picked accidentally. In fact, I'll just tell someone in the office, like, dude, is he still logged in? Go change that skin tone. Just change it back.
Mm-hmm.
Make it white.
Make it white. Just be yourself. Yeah. Even if yourself is trash. So,
you know, I had a bunch of trolls really upset about the Raise Better White People t-shirt.
I bet they
and
were.
One literally changed their Avi in the middle to a black woman. And I'm like, you're so obviously trolling in blackface. It was so bad.
They're terrible.
Terrible. Trolling in blackface is very usually pretty obvious.
Yeah.
We white people just like...
Y'all are really not even good at trying to pretend to be black, so...
We did that in the last episode where the graffiti was like... One of them was like, blacks rule. And black was like, black people don't even say blacks. Like, nobody says blacks.
Nobody says the blacks.
Racist white people say the blacks.
Pretty much.
No black people say the blacks.
Totally.
Please continue.
Mm-hmm. So I just had a couple of news stories that were related to like TV, movie, music, because we usually end the end of the show about those things. The first was Slate put this article out about new pop culture trend alert, the black lady therapist. And I've actually noticed this on a couple of TV shows, now that they mention it, from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend to You're the Worst. They seem to be everywhere. For some time now, therapists have helped movie and TV characters cut through the emotional core of their messy lives. Crazy Ex-Girlfriend Rebecca Bunch has taken her sage and very patient psychiatrist Dr. Noelle Akopian, oh god, that poor woman, on a tumultuous ride of lows and occasional breakthroughs that have largely culminated in her ignoring her doctor's advice. When Alana from Broad City needs to confront her inability to orgasm, she seeks out a sex therapist, a soothing, free-spirited woman named Betty. And on the most recent season of Grace and Frankie, Saul and Robert seek professional counseling from Rebecca on how to navigate marriage to one another as older out gay men. Each of these characters are wrestling with different illnesses. All the therapists offering them professional guidance are portrayed by black women. This certainly isn't There are certainly examples in which this isn't the case. Tina Fey is Kimmy Schmidt's wacky therapist, while Diane and Mr. Butternut's couples counselor on BoJack Horseman is voiced by Lorraine Bracco. But if you watch enough shows with dysfunctional protagonists who get to the point of seeking help, you might notice a lot of familiar black female character actors are popping up in roles that require they wield a notepad, a pen, while listening intently to other people's problems. And with rare exception, their patients are usually white or at least moderately affluent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you throw into the, in terms of the archetype that the psychiatrist portrays in these, you know, movies and TV shows and whatnot, there's a bunch of other ones where the black woman isn't a therapist, but is sort of like similarly ancillary related, but in a very specific way. I'm trying to think of an example. There's two shows where both times the mortician, right? So the show is about cops or detectives, but they have to like talk to the morgue, and both times it was a black woman. You know, I feel like that's been other. There's something there. Someone smarter than me, like Sharonda, should write an article about it.
Yeah, probably. But they're basically the article is posing this question: like, is the black lady therapist just the latest outgrowing of the storied black best friend trope that we are very familiar with? So is it just kind of morphed into this other thing now? I don't know if that is or isn't the case. I will say that there is this kind of like, you know. We tend to position black women in media, specifically in like consumable media, like TV, movies, and that sort of thing, in a few different like lanes, and so I feel like this is in that same lane as the best friend trope, where you're supposed to supposed to be like so understanding, you're supposed to listen, you're supposed to help the white people with their problems, etc.
And those two people that played the morgue women did the exact same thing. Like the detective ladies would come down and be like, blah 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 blah. Oh, now we figured it out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Almost like muled in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it is an outgrowth of that kind of trope.
Maybe. I don't know if it is or it isn't. I just would say that that's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
To keep an eye on.
I hadn't thought of it or noticed it, but you listed like 8 shows.
Yeah, it's a lot of them.
There's a few others that don't, but you know, the predominance is, I think.
Because there's so few roles already on those types of shows for black women. So to see them so consistently in that one role is what makes it like stick out, I would say.
It's one of the acceptable lanes.
People were all up and through these shows, it wouldn't even matter that the therapist was black, right?
Yeah.
So the other thing I want to talk about was in movies. We went to see Black Panther again. Shout out to Black Panther and Wakanda. Wakanda forever. We did our part because Black Panther has now officially surpassed the Avengers, setting a new standard for superhero films 2 months ago. This is from Forbes.com. 2 months ago, if you had suggested that Black Panther would become one of the highest grossing films of all time in the United States, even the most hopeful box office analysts would have laughed you out of the theater. Well, let me fix that, because I would say the most hopeful white box office analyst would have laughed you out of the theater. And yet, by the end of this weekend, and likely by the end of today, this was published on Saturday, actually. The Ryan Coogler-directed film will surpass the $1.2148 billion global cross of Iron Man 3 to become the biggest solo superhero flick of all time internationally, and third overall behind the first two Avengers, and it will edge out the Avengers' $623 million domestic total to become the biggest stateside superhero film of all time, bar none. Wakanda forever. It goes without saying at this point, but I'll say it anyway. There is no precedence. Let me say that again. There is no precedent for a success like Black Panther has defied the loftiest box office expectations, but with day one has shown incredible legs. It's the first movie to top the box office for 5 consecutive weekends since 2009's Avatar, and garnered almost unanimously rave reviews. And like the previous record holder before, Black Panther set a new standard for what superhero genre can achieve, not just commercially, but also artistically. Mm-hmm. Let's rewind to the turn of the century, when the superhero film genre was still in its relatively cartoonish infancy, where Sam Raimi was hired to direct Spider-Man in 2000. He was taking the reins for a film that had been stalled for nearly 25 years, yet he managed to combine the campiness of vintage superhero franchises like the original Superman with cutting edge visual effects, and went on to make $114 million in its opening weekend in 2002, becoming the first film to break $100 million in its debut frame, and going on to gross $403 million domestically, the highest total for a superhero movie at that time.
Prompting Marvel to form their own IPO for $1 billion, so they can have their literally, own studio and produce these movies. I mean, like, they're like, oh shit, we sold that to Sony and they made $500 million.
Yeah.
Oops.
Spider-Man reigned supreme in the superhero genre 6 years, until Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight obliterated record books in 2008, opening with a staggering $158 million and going on to gross $533 million domestically in its primary run, adding an extra $1.5 million in its re-release in 2012. The second installment in Nolan's Batman trilogy offered a gritty narrative that felt more like a crime drama than a superhero flick at times, along with morally ambiguous anti-hero in Bruce Wayne. Mm-hmm. DC would later try to replicate this tonal shift in Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice to diminishing results. The Dark Knight also provided one of the most iconic villains in movie history, with the Joker, played by Heath Ledger, obviously. And speaking of the Avengers, the first ensemble film in the MCU broke a slew of records upon its release in 2012, including opening weekend record at the time, $207 million. It went on to gross $623 million domestically, which was good for the biggest domestic superhero film of all time and the fifth highest, soon to be sixth, domestic grosser overall, not adjusted for inflation. Critically, The Avengers was not quite the unequivocal success that The Dark Knight was, but it consummated a half decade of meticulous work building the MCU. It proved that Iron Man, Captain America, Thor, and the Hulk could somehow fit on the same screen as they banded together to defeat the sinister Loki. The sequel, Age of Ultron, fell far short of its predecessor, grossing a relatively meager $459 million domestically, but the original Avengers remains an incredible success and held its mantle of the biggest superhero film of all time for 6 years. Until now, bitches. It's fitting that Black Panther has now clawed past the Avengers to become the biggest domestic superhero movie of all time. For one, King T'Challa will appear in next month's Avengers, which means his superhero box office supremacy could be short-lived. But Black Panther also marks a major evolution in the genre. It incorporates the fantastic comic book elements and snarky humor of Spider-Man, the emotionally supercharged high stakes of The Dark Knight, while also preparing to enter the greater MCU that the Avengers introduced to viewers. But it's also a socially conscious film, celebrates Black excellence, giving its women great power and brilliance, and riffs on contemporary social issues, thus blurring the lines between fantasy and reality. Black Panther takes place primarily in a fictional African nation of Wakanda. There's nothing imaginary about King T'Challa and Eric Killmonger's conflicting opinions about how best to aid Black communities around the world. The struggles presented in Black Panther reflect real-world problems, and the film's overwhelming critical and commercial success will hopefully usher in an era of socially conscious superhero cinema.
Yeah.
How about that? So, yes. Also, of course, you know, diversity does sell when a movie's good. So that's something else that approved. And hopefully we'll get more of that, too.
Agreed.
Woo-woo. I saw this thing about books. It says, romance so white. This is from The Guardian. Publishers grapple with race issues. Oh, wait. Before that, was there anything you want to add? Your second viewing of Black Panther? I didn't know if you had any
spoiler, but you and I, we talked about a bunch of stuff.
Look here. This shit is the fifth highest grossing movie of all time in the United States. If y'all ain't seen it by now, I can't help you. You're going to be spoiled.
And I can't remember what we talked about. Do you remember what we talked about? There's a couple of things that I said, like, oh, just like on second viewing, like the whole first scene where you go, tell me a story. It's basically a parable for the entire movie, you know, like front end to end.
Why do you think it's a parable for the whole movie?
Not a parable, but he talks about all the various things about what's going to happen and the, you know, challenge day and stuff. It's just, you know.
Oh, he doesn't talk about challenge day in that beginning. It talks about the history of Wakanda. It doesn't talk about challenge day. No. Are you watching the same movie?
Yeah.
It wasn't definitely well, that like beginning said, part was a historical lesson.
There was a bunch of things that I noticed the second time around, but that was days ago. So,
all right, cool. Romance So White, publishers grapple with race issues among author protests. New report exposes decline in diversity in romance writing as editors resigns after telling author they avoid putting non-white characters on covers, quote, because we like to sell books.
We just this is juxtaposed with the blackest movie ever.
Why I put it up here.
Yeah, like, and just publishers that industry, I think, is like slow to.
Queer romance writer Cole McCade came forward last week to reveal conversations with editor Sarah Lyons of the New Jersey-based publisher Riptide. McCade, who also writes as Zen Sanders, described Riptide as at all levels hostile to me as a person of color. He published an email from Lyons in which she told him, quote, we don't mind POC, but I will warn you, and you have no idea how much I hate having to say this, we won't put them on the cover because we like to book to sell. I'm blinking right now. Y'all can't hear it, but I'm blinking. Lyons has since resigned. Oh, because that's the problem. It's just this one bitch. As Riptide authors came forward to ask for their books to be pulled from the publisher's list in the wake of McKay's revelations, the publisher issued a statement. Oh, wait. We might be able to put this under...
apologies?
Yeah. Let me see here. This is their statement on Sarah Lyons.
Hold up. That's it.
We have accepted Sarah Lyons' resignation as editorial director at Riptide Publishing, effective immediately. In her business relationships with Zen Sanders, her behavior was unacceptable, and we do not condone it in any way. Romance is an intimate business, but there is no denying that Sarah's behavior crossed the line, and that her behavior is not just her responsibility. It is also ours because she represented our business. We apologize to anyone her behavior has hurt, though it is challenging to oversee the day-to-day operations of staff without a shared office space or entire office staff work. Works from home offices. We are implementing closer oversight of the editorial process. Some of the oversights include a prohibition against contacting authors outside of a company email or phone, and an updated editorial handbook with a vastly expanded section on both cultural sensitivity and professional boundaries. As well, our inboxes, ears, and hearts are open to anyone who wishes to share their stories or concerns with whomever at the company they might most be comfortable speaking with. We also removed Kate DeGroote from our freelance editorial roster shortly after she was brought on because of conflicts with authors and shortcomings shortcomings in her work. Over the course of 2015 and 16, incidents occurred that compelled us to take a hard look at the culture of racism in romance. We have made mistakes. We own our missteps, and we apologize once again to anyone we hurt because of them. Since 2016, when Zen experienced the issues he shared today, we have taken many steps to grow, change, and do better, both as individuals and as a company, and we are committed fully to both the execution and the spirit behind them. We instituted our sensitivity reader program. We created a priority submission process for writers of color. This year, we hired 4 new editors of color across different racial and cultural backgrounds. We do not condone Sarah's statement to Zen about people of color on cover art and are including people of color on our covers of books featuring non-white characters. We know these steps are just the beginning and our work is not done. We must do more than apologize for harm done. We must continue to change, and our commitment to do so is unwavering. Once more, we express our sincerest apologies. We are listening.
Whoa.
I was just going
to
say
that. Riptide Publishing. Wait a minute. Wait a motherfucking minute out here, y'all.
I was thinking like really like a solid two and a half.
Hold up.
And then they
Rachel really, Hamowitz, principal, and Tal Valenti, principal. Look.
It definitely, they, where's our 8 points? Let's go down to them.
Right. It's 6 points, but I'm like, look, they might get a 3.
I just said that was 2.5 until the very end.
They might get a 3.
I can't see the points on this one anymore. Oh, well, it's not an old one. It's missing. But no, they hit a lot of it. They definitely took, they acknowledged it. They took acceptance. I think there's a little bit of like, they only are coming this official because they got caught. Like someone published
it. Well, no, because they said that most of the stuff that they implemented, they implemented in 2016.
That's where I got the 3 towards the end, but they still use like a little bit of who's offended. I loved, you can talk to anyone.
Well, no, because here's what they said. I actually said that we apologize to anyone her behavior has hurt.
Oh, that's true. That's different. What was the last
one? And they
one?
Said we must do more than apologize for harm done. Listen, that sentence alone is acknowledging that harm actually was done. Not if, but that it actually happened.
That's a pretty good apology.
Yo, I'm giving them a 3. Let me, where my bell at? Hold up.
I'll have one for you. That's pretty good. Right. I like that they took.
All right,
they
Riptide.
They took a lot of action.
They did. There's a lot of like specific action to actually address the issues that were raised. I mean, hiring sensitivity readers, huge. A priority submission process for writers of color, and they hired 4 new editors of color.
And you didn't even hit the thing that I would say was number one. The number one thing. You are not allowed to contact authors outside of a community, company-wide communication system. It's the equivalent of recording everything you do. Mm. And it's basically, to me, I don't say that's the biggest step, but they're like admitting that the absence of this. They said we have a distributed workforce. We telecommute, and that poses problems, and we're going to address that. And one of them was like, bam, like that's going to make a huge difference.
Oh boy, I'm reading the article a little further.
Wait a minute. The three's in jeopardy.
It's got a scar. But the uproar continued to grow as authors and readers shared Riptide's previous missteps. In 2016, it apologized after one of its novels featured a black character who was referred to as Dark Chocolate Love Monkey. Earlier, it also apologized for a website for a series set in a world where slavery remained legal, which included fake ads for buying and recruiting slaves. Riptide issued
a
subsequent.
I'm still stuck about the character's name. How do you have a bunch of fucking meetings with people reading? I just can't.
Okay, I'm gonna keep reading because this is really
bad.
Getting.
It's so bad.
Riptide issued a subsequent statement that acknowledged that apologies are not enough and that the anger that has been directed towards in the past days is justified. It has closed its doors to unsolicited submissions and returned rights to angry authors who have sought to dissolve relationships with us. We need to prune the aspects of our company or attitudes in our message that are rotten. It takes it's time for us to take a good hard look at ourselves and foster new diverse voices to help us see what we've missed in the past. But the controversy arrives as a report into diversity in the genre found that fewer books by authors of color were published in 2017 compared to the previous year, despite an increase in the number of books published overall. Clearly, there's plenty of room to pull up more chairs as long as the people sitting in those chairs are white, wrote the report's authors B and Leah Koch, who run the romance bookstore, The Ripped Bodice, in Culver City. The report revealed that for every 100 books published by leading romance press in 2017, only 6.2 were written by people of color, down from 7.8 in 2016.
That's not just a small drop. That's like
it's a big drop.
It's, like a, it's more like a 20% drop.
Especially when they, as they said, the number of total books went up. So that's worse.
It's even worse. The pie got bigger and the slice for black authors got smaller.
By far the best reporting publisher was Simon & Schuster's imprint Crimson with 29.3% of titles by authors of color. But in the same week as reported, Simon & Schuster announced that the imprint will close, citing changing consumer reading habits and a continual evolution in the marketplace. It follows Harlequin's decision last year to close its African-American imprint in Kimani, citing that at the time that changes in the retail landscape and reader preferences and declining support from retailers.
So. Are they trying to say black people aren't buying books anymore? Is that the-
well, I would probably say that a lot of black folks are getting their romance reading from independent authors now. Because I don't need to come to you for your white sanitized like version of black romance. Like, yeah. I could just buy it directly from the people writing it. So anyways, I just wanted to bring that up. I thought it was interesting. You know, I'm always interested in publishing stuff. Publishing world things. Kidlet, etc. This was just one more thing. So we did watch a few things. We played a little hooky one of the days this week, and we binged the second season of Santa Clarita Diet with Drew Barrymore and Tom. What's his name? Oliphant.
Timothy Oliphant.
Loved the show. Really funny. We had actually binged the first season last year when it came out, and we were in Toronto, so it was a little revisiting for us to watch together like that. And you know, Timothy Oliphant's cute, good-looking dude. He always plays these like brooding-ass characters. But low-key, he's one of the funniest motherfuckers
on
the planet.
He is so hilarious. He's like goofy and endearing. I love it.
Oh my gosh.
I love it.
So funny.
And his reaction to, again, is like not a spoiler alert. It's like the first episode of really, like his wife turns into a zombie, right? And his reaction to that's just been great. It's like hilarious. I love it. He's just like a doting husband and a goofball.
Yeah, totally. I absolutely adore it.
It's been good. We watched The Great British Bake Off because the U.S. version got shelved because of Me Too issues. Mm-hmm. But I like it. I love watching baking shows and people fucking make shit and stuff.
It was good.
It was wasn't a bad season.
I feel like it was weird. I thought the challenges, like the themes for each week were very loosey-goosey. And so I didn't like that.
Yeah, they had one that was batter.
Like French bat. I don't know. It was just, I didn't like it. But batters, they were really hard, too, I thought.
Yeah, well, I thought the middle one, the technical bake, where they don't know what, they get like, it's a mystery, that one, was way harder than they've ever had. But hey, and there's a bunch of like shit I'd never heard of before, like British crumpet things, you know, because it's British. And we watched all of Jessica Jones.
Yep.
And I personally liked it. It was a little slow burn for me. I would have liked more to happen in the 10-episode arc.
You'd be too, like, expecting too much.
Nah, it was good. It just, you know, I would have liked more sooner.
Okay. I liked it. I love Jessica Jones. I think it's the best Marvel TV show on Netflix, in my opinion.
All right. We haven't talked about it, and we haven't gone back to it, but we watched a bunch of Lucifers.
Yep, we did.
I don't know if it's like streaming because it's actually on like CBS or something.
Oh, I think it's on Fox. I don't know if it got canceled or not, but we're
like
behind.
There's three seasons of it.
Yeah, so we're behind. So we'll be catching up in replay. But maybe we really liked it.
We're talking about black therapist. His therapist is a white woman.
Yes.
But the relationship between him and his therapist is kind of
hilarious. Yeah. So funny.
That's pretty good.
So that we watched. And then Michelle and Dago Cello's new album is actually out. It's streaming right now. And I thought, since people like when we play music, I could play a little. So for those who don't know, it's called Ventriloquism. It just came out and it is a cover album of songs, R&B songs, hit songs from the late 80s, early 90s, mostly 90s. And they're really good. So the first one is a late 80s song. I think it came out in 89, which is, go ahead.
We talked about this last week as she had said that, who was it?
Bruno Mars.
Bruno Mars was a karaoke singer. And you thought this was basically a statement about.
To me it is. Cause I was saying that to me, like she took inspiration from the same genre and the same artist that he did. But instead of just mimicking their sound, she took inspiration from what they did and created something totally different. So I'll play a few songs. Y'all will know the songs, but they will sound really different when Michelle plays them on this album. So this one is a Lisa and Cult jam fave of mine. Oh, wait, it's not playing. Take me home. Okay, so obviously that's very different from Lisa Lisa and Colchown's version. I just love it.
I love the ventriloquism compared to her calling him a karaoke artist.
Mm-hmm. It's great. I'll probably just do two more songs. Do you have any favorites that you remember?
Play the Waterfalls.
Okay. So long story short, I hate the song Waterfalls by TLC. Like, honestly, like every time it comes on, I hear the fucking beginning of it and it just makes me angry. Until Michelle.
I'll say this. I don't hate it, but it's like you hear it at the dentist's office.
It's a terrible song.
This is a fucking jam.
It's already dope. Sounds like a Prince song now. I'm so sorry I hurt you so much. Please ask about pain. Can you keep yourself out of trouble? Can you keep yourself out of trouble? All this press ain't helping at all. Okay, so obviously another stellar. So I said, to me, she reworked that to make it sound like a Prince song. She also covers Prince on the album. She covers Sometimes It Snows in April. What were you going to say?
There's a distinct difference, too, in reworking somebody's original piece because you pay them as the writer.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
As the artist. They get royalties as writing the thing. Even though you're singing it completely differently.
Right.
They get a specific royalty. Whereas Bruno didn't give, he just wrote, he kind of not rewrote everything, but like, you know what I mean? Like, there was no royalties given to
So it's interesting. So I said she covers or they cover the group that covers Sometimes It Snows in April, also Atomic Dog. I'm gonna play that just because I couldn't even imagine how they were gonna do it. Little known fact, Atomic Dog was written by a white dude in Sweden. To me it sounds like a western, like country western song.
Bluegrass,
yeah. Steel guitar involved or something. Anyways, I just thought it sounded really cool. I'll play one more, which I think will be Private Dancer, because I just think it's really pretty. Her
to this place.
mean, come on. It's ridiculous. Anyways, y'all should check it out. It's on Tidal. I think it's on Spotify as well. And you can also buy it, I'm sure, on iTunes. But Michelle DeCocello, Ventriloquism. She covers Albie Shore's Night and Day, Ralph Tresvant's Sensitivity, Tender Love by the Force MCs, Don't Disturb This Groove, Smooth Operator by Sade. Honestly, it's 11 tracks. It's less than an hour. And we listened to it and it ended and you were like, could you just start over?
I really
again?
Did. It was on NPR's first listen. I was like, just hit
play one more time. Again. Yeah, because it was that good.
It's awesome, but it is like it used to be, like 40 some odd minutes.
Yeah.
It's not hour plus.
It's 53 minutes. Yeah. 53 and a half minutes. So it's close to an hour. Mm-hmm.
So I mentioned before Diplo, and there was an article. If you don't know.
Who Diplo, is this Diplo dude? Yeah, anyways.
I'll play some.
Okay, because I don't know nothing about this Diplo. Okay.
This is called Express Yourself featuring Nikki da B, and it's basically like Big Freedia style.
Okay. So it's bounce.
Yeah. But EDM or whatever.
Is that his like most famous song?
I don't know if it's his most famous.
What's his most famous song?
I have no fucking clue.
Okay.
But this is his shit. You can see it's clearly like.
It sounds like techno.
It's techno, but he's very like taking like trap kind of.
They say this is his number one track on the titles. Allegedly. You know this song?
No idea. But let it play.
I'm sure everyone's like, how do you not know Diplo? I don't know who Diplo is. Sorry, guys. I'm old.
Well, you can just pause. Here's the, in my opinion.
Okay,
and maybe I'm wrong, but there's sort of like a new generation of what probably was producers before, but they're now like DJs.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah.
So like Nate Scott Storch, you get Diplo, is what you're saying.
I think so, but okay. But now there's this like fine line between what is you creating new music versus you like tearing up, chopping up, and redeploying, you know, like a dub, like you said, like a trap electronic, what do they call it? What was the word you used? I keep saying dub. That's not the right word. Techno, right?
Techno, okay.
Like, you know, they do like some techno EDM version of a song. But there's even one who I kind of liked, Pretty Lights. And he took other people's stuff and it was so expensive to like pay them that he decided rather than sell his music, he gave it away for free. But then he got really big and he goes on the club circuit, goes all over the place, and he makes music playing basically shit that he kind of like, I don't want to say stole, but like, he ain't paying royalties because he can't. And he's getting around it by not selling the music. So like every time the law has changed, the people using music in a variety of ways have changed. Like before when, who was it? Beastie Boys made Paul's Boutique.
Yeah.
There's so many samples on that like, and at that point it was the, you could get away with anything under 8 bars. It's why, Under Pressure could be stolen by, what's his name? White dude. You know.
Vanilla Ice.
Vanilla Ice, right?
Van whatever.
Yeah, right. Because doom, diddle, doom, diddle, doom, doom, ting. And he's on MTV, that ting, that 8th bar is why I can get away with it. Because at the time, the law was 7 bars, you can do what you want. Mm-hmm. Then the law changed to any recognizable. You know, even if it's a couple of bars, if it's recognizable, you got to give some royalties. And an album like Paul's Boutique wouldn't be made. You just couldn't make it in this new era of how music is being paid with royalties. And so now the Pretty Lights and other people get away with it by not selling their music, not monetizing it, but being a DJ that plays it at clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so he on this, and I didn't even read the whole thing. The headline said it enough. But Diplo, what kind of music am I supposed to make? And apparently references Appalachian Philly music. But, you know, I don't know what you're supposed to make, but you could be a producer. You don't have to be the DJ, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know the answer to it. But I know that there's an awful lot of white artists that if that, you know, call it cultural appropriation, you know, utilize primarily black
music.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whether it be trap or
bounce or go-go or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. It gets chopped up, consumed and redeployed as techno and people love it. And like this Diplo guy's huge. When I say, like, how do you not know him? Like, he's really big. He probably makes you know, tens of millions of dollars a year.
I bet. We have come to the end of the show. Look at that.
Look at that.
Look at that. We did it.
We did not make tens of millions of dollars with the Interracial John.
No.
Do we make tens of dollars?
We don't make any of dollars. We make zero of dollars.
This should be expressed in the cost.
Yeah.
Cost dollars.
It costs money to do the show. That's about all that happens. And time, but we love it. So
we're
it's
in
great.
The pipe. Bye, bye, bye.
Bang.
It's all good. Bang.
So till next week.
Bang on cue.
Yes.
Right. Good night, everybody.
High five.